Okay, let's continue from the lamp designs. And
oh, yeah. I was working at for Hydrix in New York, designing lamps and accessories. And that was a very, very interesting job because it gave me a chance to utilize the heavy industrial equipment to make things of more scale. But also how to use a bandsaw that was like 24-inch throat, and you could really put a log into it. And that was very exciting to me because I saw that there was a possibility of connecting art and industry, and that came to pass much later on in a very important way. And that was at the Pipe Factory when I began to discover how you could use their facilities to make sculpture. So, one of the things that I was doing at the Art Students League was studying abstract painting and realistic painting all at the same time, with an eye toward being able to teach a wide diversity of students when I finally got to teaching. And it was very difficult because going from one class in the morning, say from 8:30 in the morning until 11, I had this very abstract instructor who insisted on bold patterns and colors and whatnot. And then in the afternoon, I would have to change gears and work with somebody who was almost an academician. His idea was that there were precise forms that you had to perceive and transfer to your canvas. So that kind of combination turned me into a very versatile producer of art. And I've seen now where that was very useful, not just to teach, because it did help there, but when I'm asked to do a commission, I like to tailor the job to the situation. If it calls for a very abstract pattern, can deal with it. If it in turn calls for an illustrative a collection of detail, I can deal with that. So any way I look at it, it was worth doing that way, even though it was painful at the time. I guess it was a little bit like a contrasting jazz and classical music, you know, something like that. I suppose I'm someplace in the middle now. But there myself to Bernstein.
I guess through
sort of straddles both areas.
He loves jazz.
Yeah.
Well, you know, over the years, I guess you've seen styles or trends in art come and go, and how have they influenced you?
Well, they have, because, you know, everyone wants to be in the swim. And, of course, nowadays, it's not so important to me anymore. But there was a time when I wanted to swim to the top along with some others. So I was doing what was then voguish, even from very early on. I guess it had to be my first show was at the Bessemer Gallery, which is now a parking garage across from the Fulton Theater. It used to be a building exactly like the Fulton Theater, I mean the Fulton Building, but it was a little bit different in the design, but about the same height, built about the same time, I guess. And it was in that building that Ad Art Studio School was located. And there was on the second floor, or the mezzanine, a fellow who owned a gallery there. His name was Harry Schuick. And Harry was a painter, but he also owned this gallery. And I would stop in there, just not only to see the art, but to picture how I would might fit into that, you know. And so I asked him one time, the first year I was at Ad Art, said, how about giving me a show here? I'm ready, you know. And he said, bring in some drawings, we'll take a look. So I brought in some drawings I'd made while I was helping my dad in the strip. And my drawings I made of horses and wagons, and things of that sort. And he was quite taken with the drawings. He said, come back next year. So I did. I came back the next year. And he saw what improvement I had made. And he said, okay, you got a show. So in October of that next year, I had a show at the Bessemer Gallery. I was 18 years old. So I was really quite, you know, driven, you know, which really dissipates after a while, you discover that's not what life is really about. Mm-hmm. You know. So I put that kind of drive aside and turned my attention to teaching, also to just improving my own work and saying what I want to say. So, it's a good way it's sort of worked out.
Yeah, I wonder if we were to walk through your studio, that this would either give us ideas of questions or remind you of things that you would like to say.
Well, you could, I suppose, yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, talking about your students over the years, are there any names that have made it in the Pittsburgh or international or national scene that
we
would know?
Well, in the Pittsburgh scene, there certainly are a number of them. The first one would be Adrian Heinrich, H-E-I-N-R-I-E-C-H. Adrian is one. And then I won't say that Donna Bongren has been a student, but she has been an associate for a number of years, and I think there's been some influence there. She's an important thing, and is having a show right now at the LEG. A young guy by the name of John Deckard, who's now up in Erie, Pennsylvania, who still makes a considerable living from printmaking, etching. Then there have been several that have been at Chatham. Nancy Beale, who's in New York, has a studio there. And Nan Paul Lombardi, also a painter, just opened a studio on Broadway. So there have been a sprinkling, I won't say it's been enormous enough. But for a number of years, I taught at the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts a class called the Criticism Seminar. And the idea of that class was for students to bring two pieces of work to class, and then I would do a critique of their work and try to advise and help. And that went on for, I guess maybe 6 or 7 years. And it got to the point where they kept coming back, and I felt as if I'd become a crutch. So I said, I want you guys to quit. So we want to go to somebody else, because you need to get some other influences. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. So I said, well, if you don't quit, I'll quit. So I did, I quit. And I stopped teaching my class. But what happened was, I never thought about this, what happened was they had, some of them had banded together, and they're doing their own criticism among each other at their own homes. And this has been going on for a number of years now. So as if I got some kind of a monster going here, you know, no way to stop it. But it's been real nice, and very glad and pleased that they carry it forward. So that's what's happened. And I'm thinking now about when the center is remodeled and the dust settles, the lottery name, you know, kind of something like that, where younger people start a new group. You might call it drawing criticism, or drawing and thinking, or, you know, something like that that would be stimulating. Get some people that are on their way up instead of those who are already pretty much locked in what they're doing.
But do you see your future to be in the art?
Oh, well, now I have all the tools. I've got a philosophy, I've got an outlook, and I would say I'm fully equipped now to do some work. And that's what I want to do. I want to do some work. I am doing it. I don't think I can be hard enough on myself to narrow it down to just the finest thing. But I also have a different, I have this very unique attitude, I guess it is. It's not really unique, but it is not the usual attitude. It's what I call a 35 millimeter principle, where you take 36 shots on a roll, and out of that you get 2, 1, maybe, as against the 4x5 principle, where you probably wait for the light to be just right, and all conditions to be perfect, snap one picture. So I don't want to invest my time that way. I'd rather do a series of things. You know, cull out the bad ones and get down to the heart of it. So that's been the direction I've chosen to go in. So I did a whole body of work not too long ago at a factory in Logan, Ohio. And of these, if maybe 3 or 4 survived. And then I brought some material back with me, and I made some new pieces, which I'm drawing now. And those survive. I wrote them at 2 or 3. So that way I'll have a body of work, and the very best I can focus, and just abandon the idea.
I do have bashing qualities, so you know, take some things down off the shelf and say, you've lived long enough, bang, bye. That way I clear the shelf, make room for something else, and give up trying to save something. That's a bad future. Continue trying to save something. But you can't wipe anything out because some things come out of salvage material. So I found I'm able to do that occasionally.
Is this 35 millimeter the philosophy and outlook that you're speaking of?
Yeah. That's why I call it the 35 millimeter principle. That's right.
But you don't literally make 35 pieces.
No. It's just in the concept of making a lot of things and then, you know, chucking most of them except to get down to the
finest.
That's the idea. Which is what a photographer does.
Yeah.
He shoots a whole roll, he picks out one print, that's it.
Yeah.
And, but also, you do get a certain spontaneity that way that you wouldn't get if you were shooting 4x5. You grab it. You know what I mean by 4x5?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Like Ansel Adams, some of those, you know, Weston, they took hours and hours to prepare everything. They just went. And once they had done that, what if it wasn't good enough? What if it wasn't any good? Also, there's a kind of methodical, laborious quality about the work that doesn't appear in the work of photographers who are much more spirited. The reason I'm interested in photography is because while I was in the Army, I was a photographer. I photographed German installations. I photographed American installations to see how well they worked. You know, we both in the air and then on the ground. And we were also, it was our job to design decoys and dummy installations. We could set up an entire motor pool in an open field in about, I'd say, maybe 4 hours. And from the air, it looked exactly like a whole field full of trucks. But there were only sticks and canvas, that's all. So it was really a major decoy.
In talking to you, the words that come to my mind are practical and pragmatic.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you're interfacing life with art, you have to bring some practicality to it, you know. So,
and you're flexible?
Well, yeah, I guess I like to think I am. Everybody likes to think they're flexible.
But,
you know,
then those kind of words just seem to be so inconsistent with the artistic temperament that I had stereotyped for myself in my mind about artists.
Yeah. Well, I guess you probably have, there's probably a lot of truth in what you're saying. Because if I go to a factory, introduce what I want to do, explain to you what I might accomplish, I'm able very quickly to become cordial with the workers.
Yeah.
We have no problem interacting. And in that sense, they probably have a notion that I'm really serious about what I'm doing and I know what I'm doing. And they probably appreciate that. So I've been very lucky. I've gone to a number of factories. Every place I've ever been has been very friendly and very
popular. You get along with them. Oh, yeah. I could see that immediately.
No problem at all. So maybe that's where it's very visible. But then there are other problems that have to be solved. You make the greatest work of art, but if you can't install it, if it's too big or too heavy or whatever, there are practical considerations you have to have at your disposal and then to solve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess there's some of that.
Are you still working with
Raku? Yes, I am, right. And in fact, I've just developed, refined the technique I've discovered in 76. I discovered the technique of making a drawing of bone on a plate or whatever, and using smoke to create the drawing. And now I've refined it to the point where there's very little smoke. Most of the smoke goes to make the drawing. So one can almost do it inside the building. You don't have to do it outside. And that's a real advance. So I sent out a whole bunch of flyers to announce this and to solicit
interested people that I want to have me come to the workshop. And the response has been very good. People have been quite curious about how you can have a raccoon with a smooth. So I'm not even going to tell you.
Would you explain to Chuck, I was trying to explain raccoon is not, I was not doing a good job.
Well, raccoon is a ceramic process where you open the kill while it's red hot and you reach in with a pair of tongs. You take the ware out of the kill while it's glowing. And you put it in a container that's filled with leaves or newspaper or straw or whatever. And it will burn quickly. And you clap a lid on it to keep the smoke in. Now what happens is that as the pot is cooling and the glaze is settling, the oxidation, the reduction that takes place in it, because you have a high carbon atmosphere, is causing the glaze to go from green to red. So you get some very beautiful ox blood reds or bright reds in raccoon that you can't get any other way. But mostly, it's a very spontaneous process. Imagine taking that pot out of a glowing kill, putting it in newspapers, smoking it, and 15 minutes later uncovering it, and it's done. That's it. You don't have to wait 8 hours for the kill to cool down. It's a whole different ballgame. So, and because it's so spontaneous, and because it's very physical, it's been a very good way to teach students what ceramics is about. Because it's so fast. They can make pots at the beginning of the week, and by the end of the week, we can have fire and glaze. So I use it a lot to teach ceramics. It's a good introduction. It's exciting. There's fire and smoke. Instant creativity. So what I've done is a variation on that. I'm not using glaze at all. It's just smoke. So if you get a chance, I'll share a couple of pieces.
Marcia, do you have any other questions yet?
No, I offhand those might be the answers.
Well, before we wind it up, could we take the recorder back
sure.
in here?
Sure, yeah, you want to do that?
Yeah. Okay, we have now moved into Jerry's studio and workshop.
Right. I was pointing out that that collection of paintings and drawings are not mine. Many of them are other people's. I believe in collecting art as the enrichment for your environment, and as you saw in the living area, there's a variety of artworks there. And I believe in that. I think if you took away all the artwork, it would look pretty empty. I wanted also to show you what the reduction stenciling looks like. This is a piece that was just done yesterday. You need to understand the bowl was fired once with a clay, and then fresh clay is poured into it in sort of a slip, sort of a runny condition. And as it begins to firm up, you take a needle and draw through it. See, and then let that dry. So that after it's dry, you put it back in the kiln, heat it up, and take it out and reduce it. And take it outdoors to reduce it. So you get the smoke attacking wherever there is no stencil. See, each dot, each mark, each line is recorded by the smoke. And of course, as you see, the back is all black. So this is really a drawing. You put a rod across or a wire across to be hung on the wall. So it's a very unique process that came out of the raccoon tradition. In fact, as a matter of fact, I think,
Now, have commissions for these? What is your outlet
it's pure
speculation.
For selling? No, whoever sees these either in the studio here or at Gallery G, or sometimes I sold these things to Play Place and Shooting Sun, or at the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts. So there's no regular, very regular source.
And in other words, you have people who know your work and come to make appointments and come to the studio
right.
regularly.
But mostly the things I like to do here are fair sized pieces and sculpture. And there's a set of two right there, as you can see from here. I just finished in the beginning to draw. I can show you one side of them so you'll know what it looks like.
idea is to make a kind of gate, or sort of entry room.
Oh, now is this commission gate?
No.
No, oh, I see.
That's the agreement.
How do you fire things as large?
When I was teaching the channel, I had access to the kiln.
Uh-huh.
And I had a design called a test again. I could build a kiln around the piece. But now I don't have access to that. I'm thinking I might have to take it back to the back where I got the pipe.
How oh, I see.
The hall down there, and I did it. And I've got three there, and I've got three
there. Now, how do you envision this big use? Is it a real entrance, or
an entrance? No, not really. It's very short. It's a decorative entrance. Maybe considered a screen. I see the far end of the room.
Lighted.
What are your opinions about the direction art, nationally and internationally, is going? Seems to be in
New art is always a rebellion against the present. It's always seeking to find something that may not even be recognizable as art. That's fairly usual. Every century this happens. And the thing about our time is that because of magazine, newspaper, and TV, and so forth, our communication is so much faster that we go through styles every 5 years or 10 years at the most. So it's constantly in a state of flux. And I used to try to predict what it was going to be like, but there's no way you can do that. So for a while we were doing very realistic, almost photographic, you know, sort of things, and then it swung back to a much more expressionistic, and then much more severe, minimal, kind of sculpture and painting. Just as but a good work of art has a presence. It has, there's something about it. It radiates a certain quality that most people can respond to. They may not like it, but it may be so strong, so powerful, so annoying, hateful, but it does convey a strong sentiment that they have to eventually recognize that is art. I think it's probably a mistake that the critics of the Impressionists and everything
period of what they knew as a contemporary art. But they didn't realize the value has to be vigorous, it has to be diametrically opposed to what is currently stylish, modish, acceptable. How do you rebel against a canopy if you don't rebel? It's not always beautiful. Art is not always beautiful. But it is often magnificent.
Anything else you wanted to
say?
Good luck.
Thanks, Jay. Good luck to
you're
you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was wondering, Philip Preston was in my home room at Alderdice.
Oh, was he?
Were you in Alderdice then?
Yeah, yes, I was, yeah. Yeah, because he would come up to the art room.
Yeah, of course.
That's Patrick's art room, yeah. And I would work up there, too. We tried to get as much art in as we could, but lunch period, then there was a fifth period, then we come after school, and then our regular class. So we could pack in maybe four classes.
What's always remarkable is that basically I remember him doing the exact same sort of thing then, don't you? When I look back,
yeah,
those are exactly the things, the type of figure, I mean, he's much more refined now, but I can remember his art then, it looks like it does now. Am I wrong?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. The thing that I remember strongly is the piece that won the award in Scholastic.
Scholastic.
It was a merry,
yeah,
carousel.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And it was very good, actually. I wished I had done it. He did it, so that was my way. Well, Phil's very good, but you're right. He does have a narrow direction he wants to.
It seemed to me, and of course, being young at that time, his disfigures were so monstrous to me. And though I knew he was a talented man, it just was,
oh, yeah,
it just seemed like something as a youngster in those days, it was something hideous.
Here's a good example of a guy who rebelled against the reduction.
Yeah, all those years.
Everybody was saying, abstract, and he said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Establishmentarianism.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I assume this is because this is what he could do the very best.
Well, yeah, I think there was that kind of stubbornness, but partly, as you say, that was his facility, yeah.
And your drive seems to be in a female figure?
Pretty much, yeah. Sensual form.
Yeah.
Even something as architectural like that is curvilinear motif.
That
ought
to be very,
yeah,
when it's finished,
nice. Well, yeah, I hope it survives.
Very nice. You know what we'll need? Do you have a picture of yourself that we can use? Anything? And also, if there are any spare printed things from any of your shows.
Thanks again, Jerry.
You're welcome.